afternoon. My name is Latricia, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Part 2 of the Health Marketing and Communication Webinar Series conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Kimetz, you may begin the conference.
Thank you, Latricia. Hello, everyone. This is Carla Kimetz at AUCD. I'm the project specialist on the cooperative agreement with the National Center on Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities. I'm joined here by our project director, Sue Lynn. I'd like to start by giving you all an overview of today's webinar. I will be doing the welcome and introduction just to give you a few guidelines. Then we'll turn things over to our presenters. We'll have Kate Galatis, the Associate Director for Communication Science at the National Center on Health Marketing, finish up an overview of the pink book that she had started on part one of our Health Marketing and Communication webinar series. And then we'll turn things over to Meg Tracy, the Project Director of the Montana Disability and Health Program, Living Well Under the Big Sky, to provide specific examples of health marketing and communication from her CDC State Disability and Health Program. After the presentations, we'll have some discussants. Tracy Mann, who is the current AUCD Fellow at NCBDDD, and Martha Alexander, who's the Deputy Associate Director for Communication Science at NCBDDD. After that, as the operator explained, there will be an opportunity for question and answer, and she will provide those directions again so that you can know how to ask our presenters a question. I wanted to start by giving you a brief overview of the AUCD-NCBDDD Cooperative Agreement. As part of this agreement, AUCD provides many activities in the following areas: to strengthen the nation's capacity to carry out public health and disability activities, to foster collaborations among AUCD, its network, including USED's LENS and DDRC's, and the National Center on Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities. We also provide technical assistance to state disability and health grantees, one of which you will hear from today. We also enhance the capacity of states in creating collaborative systems change in the early identification, assessment, and service coordination for children with autism spectrum disorders and related disabilities through the Act Early Regional Summits. We strengthen the expertise in the fields of birth defects and developmental disabilities through training of professionals in public health and related fields. And we facilitate a wide range of research, education, and dissemination activities, one of which you are a part of today on this webinar. You can find out more information about these activities on AUCD's website. And lastly, some of you, all of you should see a panel on the right side of your screen. As you know, all of your lines have been muted during the presentation, and the operator will provide directions again at the beginning of the Q&A session. But if at any time during the webinar you have questions, you can type them into the chat box, and we will be happy to answer them at that point or save them for the Q&A session later today. At this point, I'd like to turn things over to Kate Galatis at CDC to continue the overview of the Pink Book.
Is it switched in?
Okay, great.
Good morning, or good afternoon, everyone. We are very happy to be back with you guys doing part two of the seminar. Just for, you know, real quick point of reference, last time we were together, in terms of the four stages that the Pink Book outlines, we went over stages one and two, which were the planning and development stages, where we talked about research and a few other areas. We're moving along here. We have a little technical difficulty. There we go. We talked about the planning and development stages, and then today we were going to focus just on quickly on implementation and the assessment slash evaluation stages, and we'll just basically underscore just that this is a continuum. This process you know, doesn't, you know, start and stop in one nice package. You will see that it feeds into one another. I'm going to make my comment very brief so that we maximize the time that we have for Meg's presentation, where you can kind of see all of this in action. So in terms of implementation, wanted to just really kind of underscore a couple of things on this. You know, implementation is actually, it's the fun part. It's when you get to see all your great work and plans and everything that you've been doing kind of come together, and it is can be a very exciting time. It can also be very stressful. But really here, a couple of things that I wanted to really point out for folks is that in terms of implementation, I think one thing that a lot of people could kind of fall victim to or do fall victim to is that you do all this great planning and all in the development stages, and then you switch to implementation, and we often forget that actually what you need for implementation is an implementation plan. You need a very well thought out, usually it's on a timeline where you start with, you know, let's say here's a date and, you know, at some point in time where you want to launch a campaign or a project or some set of activities, and you kind of build backwards from that, and you really have detailed, whether in a spreadsheet or some other way, you have detailed framing of each step that you need to do to go from to really have your plan come to life. And so I wanted to, you know, talk about, you know, in terms of preparation for implementation, one of the things that I really like to see is an implementation plan where you've explored partner groups that are going to be important. You've talked about, you know, different pieces are going to be owned in many terms around implementation by different people, and does everybody, is everyone clear on what their role is and when they are to do what they're to do so that everything can go off as planned. And so that kind of thinking and strategizing and planning, it, I think, is really critical and can really kind of make or break a successful launch of a campaign or a project. In terms of implementation, you'll also, you know, see in the Pink Book a lot of kind of guidance around, you know, kind of what they refer to as a launch or a kickoff event. You know, how are you going to really introduce your project and create that splash out there of interest and coverage for your program? And there's a really helpful checklist in terms of a launch that I think is really it's really enlightening. And a couple of things that they really underscore are things like, you know, have you adequately prepared your partners for the launch? So even if your partners don't have a role in the implementation or the launch, have you kept them enough in the loop that they aren't caught by surprise? That, you know, a lot of times we end up doing a communications project or intervention that actually puts an added stress or added response mode that our partners have to go into, and have we adequately addressed that? And we also, you want to make sure you're thinking through things like that. And, you know, there's quite a long list. Another item that's on the list that I thought was worth spending a little bit of time on is that in terms of media, your media outreach, if there are multiple people involved with your launch, is everyone thinking about the same main messages that you want to convey? And have all of you been trained kind of in a media, what media response will be, so that we don't have conflicting messages going on? And so that's one aspect of kind of media training around a project that I think is really important. So whether that's formal training of potential spokespersons that happens in advance of a launch, or whether it's that plus some proactive media work that you're trying to do after you launch, and again, you want to be linking people to similar messages. So kind of really thinking about that media strategy very concretely and doing the advanced kind of prep work to really be ready for the launch is really kind of critical. When it comes to the other part of implementation that I think is helpful to think about is really how are you then going to maintain, or what level of communication are you going to attempt to maintain as the life cycle of the communications project goes on. And I think that's really something that is very important for folks to think about with partners up front. So don't let yourself get to implementation and then start thinking about, oh, okay, well, you know, now how are we going to keep this going, or what are we going to do next? It's really kind of important on that during the implementation planning stage that you think about, you know, okay, we're projecting that this set of activities will last for, you know, 3 months. Well, then what happens? Or are we going to pulse things throughout the year so that we can, you know, plan for that? Are we going to assume that XYZ partner is then going to, you know, continue doing some of the more proactive stuff while we kind of are going to start to be in response mode? I mean, these are all things that, if thought about on the front end, can make for an easier transition once you have launched and you're really moving into what we would kind of consider a maintenance stage. So those are some of the things I wanted to highlight on implementation. And then when it comes to the assessment evaluation piece, I think that my main message here is really, you know, this could really span the whole gamut from, you know, full-blown outcome evaluation methods that where you're really trying to really look at health impact and really look at longer-term effects. And it could also be that you don't have the money for that at all, but that you are in partnership with your partners really looking at, okay, what can we do on a shoestring that's going to, at the very least, help us gauge whether we thought this was effective, whether we think it's worth maintaining. If we all agree that it is, then can we set up a system through which, at the very least, we're getting enough feedback that we can use it to truly inform and refine our strategies and messages as we, you know, continue in the maintenance mode. So there's a whole lot of information on this in the Pink Book. Again, we could speak for hours on just evaluation alone, and it really, what it comes down to is I'm a firm believer in doing something rather than doing nothing at all towards evaluation. So look at what is feasible, engage the partners in the evaluation effort, even if you're doing it on a shoestring, and then really try and use whatever it is you can collect to help you all make decisions about how you refine strategies and refine messages in as you then kind of maintain a communication campaign over time. So I'm going to keep my comments brief and go ahead and turn it over at this point to Meg.
Well, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed the presentations from CDC and health marketing, and it's really given us a chance to think about some of the work we do within that framework and how we can improve our work using some of the resources that they have emphasized in the last two webinars. I think my role is just to talk about what we've been doing as a state program on disability and health and the role of health marketing in those activities. Some of the photos that I've integrated into the presentation for today's webinars are my marketing effort to interest my husband in looking at the slides and helping me see typos. He works for the Forest Service here in Montana. So this first slide is a picture of two elk standing in a river near Sula, Montana during a forest fire. And the title I've given our presentation is Catching On Like Wildfire, Preventing Secondary Conditions in Montana, the Role of Health Marketing. It's just a little bit of background on who most of the folks are who work on the Montana Disability and Health Program. We come from the Research and Training Center on Disability and Rural Rehabilitation, or in the research unit here at the Rural Institute on Disabilities at the University of Montana. Tom Seekins is the director of both of those groups and really brings the vision of participatory action research and consequential science into everything we do. Participatory action research creates a dynamic interplay between researchers and potential consumers to identify problems, specify important goals, determine acceptable procedures, judge the significance of results, and disseminate useful findings. And consequential science blends the best of science with appropriate methods to solve complex human problems. So living well with a disability is one of the products I'm going to talk about today that grew out of research here at the University of Montana with help with the collaboration of researchers at the University of Kansas, and again, building from this perspective. And based on the webinar information we've gotten from CDC, you can see that a product developed with these principles applied may lend itself perhaps more easily to health marketing. And I would say that one of the main reasons for, I think, the success of Living Well is that the problem was identified, the population of interest was specified, their primary values were operationalized, and then a system or a place, as we've been talking about in the last two webinars, was identified in which to deliver the product. So let's see. The MTDH health marketing activities I'm going to talk about today are Living Well with a Disability, the Montana Disability and Health Disability Advisors, and our Accessibility Ambassadors. And again, this is work we've done kind of bottom up with our advisory group and stakeholders, and health marketing, the frameworks that we've been given in the last couple webinars is a framework that I'm going to try to apply to our work here. But again, it's new to me, and I would appreciate any input. So when we think about living well with a disability, it's really important for anybody on the call to know that Craig Ravislute is sitting here with me. He directs the Living Well with a Disability activities in his role as Director of Rural Health Research here, and Tracy Bame, who's been assisting on Living Well with a Disability activities. They're both in the room. I'm going to go through our slides, but if during question and answer you guys want to access them, they're here. The way we've been thinking about some of our products for Living Well with a Disability is the program itself and the audiences, Centers for Independent Living directors, in some cases community-based services, case managers, but it's a program where we're looking to an organization to bring on into their portfolio. Then another product is Living Well with a Disability, the facilitator training. Here again, it's the directors who are probably the gatekeepers to this training, but it's Center for Independent Living staff who are our primary audience and for whom we want to kind of shape the product and promote the opportunities to. And then finally, the product we most often associate with Living Well is the Living Well with a Disability workshop and curriculum. And here the audience is persons, adults with physical disabilities. So as a program, the product, as I said, is Living Well with a Disability, the program. We're asking the Center for Independent Living maybe to take on a new health orientation, to have trained facilitators, to implement workshops, to develop new community relationships, to collect evaluation data, and possibly have reduced health care costs for any staff or for their consumers broadly, and then increase participation of Living Well with a Disability graduates. And this is maybe getting into promotion, but Living Well with a Disability graduates are often peer advocates. So if you're at an organization and you now have peer advocates who have increased participation, that's just good for you as a center. The place that we really developed, that system that Living Well was delivered through, is the Centers for Independent Living. And importantly, centers have the reporting requirement of outcomes related to goals for increasing independence in the significant life area. The price, of course, that a director might consider are those organizational costs. Do they have the staff to do it? Can they supervise those staff? How will they recruit? Are they already recruiting their peers to other activities? Do they have the space to do it? What are some of the trade-offs that they might have to make in their portfolio? And then the way we promote to the CIL directors is through our internal and peer-reviewed publications, legislation, word of mouth, presentations. The Disability and Health Program here in Montana has contracts with our Centers for Independent Living. And then we have information on our website, both for our program, state program, and for the Living Well program itself. The other product is Living Well with a Disability, the facilitator training. Here we offer two kind of places for that to happen, the internet-based training program. That's 4 meetings scheduled over 2 weeks. And Craig does a great job of keeping the upcoming sessions on the Living Well training page of our MTDH website. And then the other option is to have in-person facilitator training. That's a 2-day seminar. And, of course, the price includes the cost of training, person's time to participate, the internet and telephone costs and materials. And our promotion strategies have been word of mouth, again, that MTDH-CIL contract, and on the website. The Living Well with a Disability workshop and curriculum, again, is that product that most people think about when we talk about living well. And it's typically delivered as an 8-week workshop. There are groups of 8 to 10 people, and those groups are facilitated by staff from a CIL. The groups meet 2 hours per week, and the facilitator guides the group through 10 chapters of a self-help workbook. Importantly, the product within the product is that each of the chapters is infused with evidence-based information on health behavior and behavior change strategies. And the chapters, again, are goal setting, and that sets that place, that context, in which all these other resources are brought to bear on reaching a quality of life goal, problem solving, healthy reactions, beating the blues, health communication, information seeking, physical activity, nutrition, advocacy, and maintenance. And one of our challenges is trying to keep that information up to date and consistent with some of the messages that are coming out, for example, through the physical activity group at CDC around guidelines. So again, I've talked about the place where the workshops traditionally take place, Centers for Independent Living, but you know, we do offer it here as a course on the University of Montana campus. It's offered through the New Directions Wellness Center. We've heard of examples of it being implemented at YMCAs, the assisted living facilities, the senior centers. And again, more importantly, it's a psychological space where quality of life goal setting is a context in which health and behavior change information is presented. Craig often says health is the means to the end, not an end in itself. And again, just going back to what Centers for Independent Living are about, that's what they're about. They're about supporting quality of life goals with people with disabilities. So it's a really natural fit. The price, it's been shown through research funded by the CDC that it is cost effective at the program level. Depending on where it's implemented, how it's implemented, the individual costs will vary. We found that the workshops are better attended in spring, summer, and early fall in Montana. There are other barriers you should consider for people with disabilities that, you know, tend to be unique challenges they face, pain, transportation. I provided a website to one of our internal publications that talks about some of those barriers, but there's a rich literature that folks can refer to as well if they try to understand the price of delivering Living Well with a Disability. How do we promote? Well, Craig suggested three slides, one with word, second with of, and mouth. So word of mouth, that's what we found works best in recruiting people to Living Well with a Disability workshops. One of the things that you might want to consider if you are trying to promote the workshop is what is the capacity of the Center for Independent Living or the host organization to communicate in this way with people with physical disabilities, and what can state programs do to build that capacity. And particularly, we want to have conversations with people with disabilities around quality of life goals, health promotion, and the Living Well with a Disability workshop. So that's our main product, Living Well with a Disability, that I wanted to talk about today. We have some other products, but in the interest of time, I wanted to take our remaining time together to talk about some strategies we've used to get some of the wonderful public health publications out to folks who need them in Montana. And on this slide, I've tried to, again, interest my husband in my work, but I've got a picture of our problem. It's a fire on Mount Sentinel. The resource is water in the Clark Fork River, and our charge is to how do we connect the two. And the Sikorsky or Sky King helicopters is how it was done here in Missoula on that day in July. They brought just buckets of water to put this fire out. And I think here the key is repetition. You know, to put that fire out. It's multiple passes. But our strategies for connecting some of the wonderful public health publications to the folks who need them on Montana were the accessibility ambassadors and the disability advisors. The MTDH accessibility ambassadors were conceived by a work group of our marketing communications committee to promote disability and health resources in Montana, and that was in 2005. The accessibility ambassadors are CIL staff or community leaders who are skilled in ADA assessment and or community relations. And importantly, again, for CILs, partnering with CILs on this ambassadors project, is that the CIL is, they're trying to increase the availability, improve the quality of community options for independent living among individuals with disabilities, and they're trying to conduct activities to increase the capacity of communities to meet the needs of individuals with disabilities. So again, it's something they're doing. It's easy for them to take on. Our primary strategies with the accessibility ambassadors has been to conduct accessibility studies of facilities. And we do this to increase the perceived usefulness of key disability and health publications among the facility stakeholders. We're trying to increase the awareness of the accessible facilities and equipment among people with disabilities. And again, we're taking those assessment data, which have been collected, again, by members of the disability community known for their expertise in ADA, so they have this social validity to them and their objective. So we try to promote those options that have been identified through the assessments. And then we're trying to increase the capacity of our Center for Independent Living staff to do assessments beyond the ADAG, to do some of the assessments that are better at describing options for fitness centers or in mammography centers. And we're trying to increase capacity of disability leaders outside of the CILs as well through this project. And then finally, we're trying to increase awareness among community partners of the Disability and Health Program and Centers for Independent Living as technical assistance partners on improving accessibility in communities. MTDH first trained 7 accessibility ambassadors in 2005 at the CANDU Festival in Butte, and again, we wanted to promote accessible health care and fitness facilities through some key public health publications, which I'll name in a minute. We also trained these 7 accessibility ambassadors to conduct the evaluations of different facilities. We gave them the University of Kansas's ADA Accessibility Stick 2, which is a really nice tool just to do the assessment, but also to leave with the facility stakeholders as, I guess it's just a really nice example of how you can go through a facility quickly and just do some check for basic accessibility. And we also gave them the checklist for accessibility assessment of physical fitness facilities, and Dot Mary from Kansas was here to train on their instrument. So they went out in the community and disseminated the North Carolina Office on Disability and Health, removing barriers to health clubs and fitness facilities, removing barriers to health care, a provider's guide for the care of women with physical disabilities and chronic medical conditions. All of those are excellent publications. We wanted to get them out in the state. The ambassadors went out, did accessibility audits, met with people personally in their communities. And again, you know, we just did the training and they went out and did this, and we did some follow-up evaluation to find out what they did. And they also distributed the National Center on Accessibility's retrofitting for accessibility and disability awareness. So that was just kind of a first effort. We didn't have a lot of money to do it, but we really wanted to make sure that these resources that we were purchasing in Montana didn't end up in the garbage can. We wanted them to end up in people's hands within a context of wanting to improve accessibility of their facility. And that's what the ambassadors did for us. So to build on the program, we sought additional funding from the Christopher Reeve Grant, and then through our current cooperative agreement with CDC, we've been able to expand what the ambassadors have done to date. The meaning of ambassador implies messenger, and indeed this project has created a network of messengers for 3 main purposes. We've worked to promote the physical activity guidelines and related accessibility options and resources, and specifically in 8 Montana communities. I hope we'll have a little bit of time to talk about that. And then we've been working to promote accessible mammography services, the breast health and advocacy for women with disabilities education materials, and we're ready to promote the right to know materials in Montana through our accessibility ambassadors activities. And then thirdly, we've been promoting visitability as a preferred home design option and an inclusive community strategy with our ambassadors. And just to give you a closer look at our ambassadors, I'll go through some of what we did in our access to fitness centers for people with disabilities. We saw in the public health data, both nationally and in Montana, that adults with disabilities were more than twice as likely to be physically inactive in a usual week as adults without disabilities. So again, like I said, we sought funding from the Christopher Reeve Grant to support our accessibility ambassadors, and then the cooperative agreement has continued our efforts to bring those numbers a little bit closer to address that health disparity. The products that we were hoping to distribute to our ambassador were action plans developed from the AIM-FREE, which is an accessibility assessment tool developed by the National Center on Physical Activity and Disability, and the ADAG. The toolkit we put together involved resources from NCBAD, North Carolina Office on Disability and Health, and information from the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation on their Quality of Life grants. We recruited 7 accessibility ambassadors and trained them. They in turn trained 19 consumers with physical disability. Those folks worked across the state to do the assessments using, again, the ADAG and the AIM-FREE. AIM-FREE has a consumer and a professional version. The ambassadors completed the professional and the consumers completed the AIM-FREE versions. And the places these assessments took place were in 8 target communities identified as having some level of readiness for information about improving accessibility and doing outreach to the disability community on physical activity. So we identified 24 facilities in 8 Montana communities. 2 were rural communities. So then we did the assessments, developed the action plans, and then the ambassadors went back in person and met with facility managers, delivered the action plans in person with the resource toolkit. And we did some follow-up survey work with the facilities and found some good things. but also some areas to improve, and I won't go into detail on this slide, but basically what we found out was, you know, again, some were ready to move forward, some needed some more products, maybe some more health marketing, and so what we've done is, working with NICPAD, we were able to give some more detail on the action plans. They wanted real specific suggestions about how to remove barriers, and NICPAD helped us develop some of those. We did an adaptive fitness training. Some fitness centers just weren't ready to give that kind of training to their staff, so we worked with NICPAD and the North Carolina Office on Disability and Health to do the adaptive fitness training here at the University of Montana in February. RERC RecTech has technical assistance available. We've made all those fitness centers aware of that. We've done a little survey of who's ready for ACSM certification that's coming up on adaptive fitness, and we'll be promoting that opportunity with those fitness centers. And then we're hoping to provide technical assistance on how to do an open house with particular outreach to the disability community. Want to do that with our fitness facilities that have options for accessible physical activity. And then these folks who came to that adaptive fitness training made us think maybe we could develop some community leaders on adaptive fitness and do some train-the-trainer models. And then we've been promoting all this work in our local media. Okay, this next strategy of getting the word out in Montana, again, came from our Montana Disability and Health Advisory Board. And the main message here is that this is funded by their board-initiated project. It's a small budget, and the work group that developed what I'll talk about disability advisors in a minute wanted to, quote, get the biggest bang for our buck. And this picture is or buck for our bang. It's not really a buck. It's a bull elk that was brought home on a Dodge Colt this hunting season here in Montana, and the picture was widely distributed this fall. In 2005, this work group of the policy committee for our advisory board conceived of the disability advisors, again, to promote disability and health resources and to bring perspectives from the disability community to key public health advisory groups. I will say this was an objective that was outlined by the Public Health and Safety Division, it had a former name at the time, in its Olmsted plan. So that public health group was really concerned about how do we support people to live in the least restrictive environments in Montana, and including people with disabilities on their advisory groups was one of their objectives. Again, I've told you it was supported with the small budget the advisory board has. It supports recruitment, training, and travel for disability leaders to serve on these health boards. And the board members saw a large potential for the project, particularly in terms of possible policy changes. And we've distributed a variety of products to these groups, and I'll name those in a minute. You know, things like the National Center on Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities chart book, alternative formats of four strategic plans, those North Carolina materials, as well as their removing barriers and planning meetings that are accessible to all participants. We've developed a publication called Involving People with Disabilities as Members of Advisory Groups. We really use that to educate the program staff who organize these advisory groups about what is disability advisors, what's that about? And then we also give them these removing barriers planning meetings so they're setting up advisory group meetings that are accessible. Living Well with a Disability, we've promoted through disability advisors. Menu aids, which if you're interested, I'll talk about it, our nutrition standards of care, our visitability publications, the Massachusetts Facility Assessment Tool, which has been invaluable in conducting our mammography center assessments this year. The Amputee Coalition of America, NICPAD, Reeve Foundation, Special Olympics, they all have great resources that at one time or another our disability advisors have brought to these places. The Montana Asthma Work Group, the Transportation Partnership, the Diabetes Coalition, Cancer Controls Early Detection Implementation Team Communications Work Group, the Stroke Work Group, of the Cardiovascular Disease Program, the Dental Access Coalition, the Primary Care Liaison Group, and our Quality Council for our Developmental Disabilities Program. Of course, the price that we have to consider of all these advisory group members is their time and energy, the competing agenda on the advisory groups. So again, the repetition piece, the timing piece, the integration piece are all really important. So we, to promote it, we really try to identify opportunities where disability resources or accessibility strategies are relevant. At the Cardiovascular Disease Health Summit, we've recruited speakers, Jim Rimmer and Dot Mary is coming this April, to talk about disability issues, and we try and time that in a way so the audience is ready for the information they have to provide. The state planning processes, we've produced alternative formats, and we've engaged the disability community members with low vision to participate in that process in that way. I also think the disability community in general likes to see those alternative formats and is more engaged when agency takes those steps. We've gotten more familiar with BRFIS data questions that various public health groups are planning and trying to think about how we can integrate disability into their analysis or make sure that items aren't somehow excluding disability-relevant issues. And then we've been able to design health marketing campaigns to include the disability community, and that includes consumers, family members, personal care attendants, and we do this by helping public health programs partner with disability organizations, and again, to disseminate alternative formats, in this case of campaign materials. And that's, I guess, all I have to say at this point, and I welcome questions. Please come visit us in Montana or on our website. This is a picture of Mount Sentinel. It's pretty much out our windows here at the university, and it's lit by a beautiful orange and red sunrise.
Meg, this is Carla. Thank you so much for your presentation, and that is a beautiful picture. At this point, we'd like to turn things over to Tracy Mann and Martha Alexander at CDC to get the discussion going.
Hi, this is Martha Alexander. Thank you so much, Meg and Kate, for your examples. And Meg, we really appreciate the principles that you illustrated, the principles of health communication and marketing with your examples, especially of showing us how we can use the four P's of the marketing mix and your strategic project, strategic process. And thank you very much for sharing your wonderful photos. Those are great, and we're all ready to visit Montana. Just in a few sentences to sum up the last webinar and this one, is a reminder that as we create health communication and marketing programs, we want to be sure and use a systematic process. We've described one systematic process that is in the Pink Book, a cyclical process to plan, develop, implement, and evaluate a health communication program. And you can use this process regardless of the topic and whether it's a national campaign like Learn the Signs or state-based programs such as the Living Well with Disability, which Meg described, or short-term interventions like we talked about in the first webinar about the health observances outreach that we do. And as Kate said, it's really important to approach health marketing as a cyclical process. And even though evaluation is labeled as number four, it's not the end at all. And Meg showed us how what you can learn from evaluation stage feeds right back into more planning. She mentioned new directions such as providing technical assistance to develop open houses, and developing local champions and then promoting this work in the local media. So just a reminder that it is a continuous loop of planning, improvement, implementation, and improvement. Also, throughout the process, we want to make sure that we develop health information and interventions that are based on science. Not only the science behind the health topic about which we are communicating and communication science, but I really enjoyed Meg's description of the participatory action research and consequential research. So those add to the body of science that we should consider in our process. And we also want to ensure that our process is based on the needs and perceptions of our audiences and that it must be customer-centered. By keeping our audience and science at the forefront and using the systematic approach, we can help protect and promote the health of our very diverse population. I think that Tracy has a first question to kick us off.
Thank you, Martha. I think it probably would help us to start with a question about, since this is about implementation and evaluation, I'm just wondering if anyone wants to share some challenges that they've had with implementation of a health campaign in their state, and maybe some techniques to get around those challenges.
Tracy, since you're posing that question to Meg in addition to the audience, I would like to ask the operator, Latricia, to explain again how someone can ask a question or make a comment via their phone.
Again, if you would like to ask a question or make a comment, press star 1 on your telephone keypad.
And Meg, you're welcome to chime in if you've had some...
Can people hear me or do I need to press star 1?
Oh, no, we can hear you.
Okay, great. I think one of our strategies when we've done, let's say, a mini conference on visitability, the audience is usually comprised of people who are hearing about visitability for the first time, some people who have some familiarity, or disability advocates who have been talking about it for years. And so when we've done kind of quick evaluations of those types of events, it's really hard to plan for that group when you're doing that post-only evaluation. So it's hard to get that individual level kind of change in awareness information. So we've tried harder to get some pre-post information using online survey work. But I would say that's a challenge to word your awareness outcomes in those post-only evaluations where you've got this diverse group of people who came in knowing everything, are glad to hear it again, are really there to meet new stakeholders, and having those questions also be appropriate for the audience. You're really just trying to expose to a notion like disability for the first time. Oh. It's tough. Post-only evaluations are tough with a diverse group.
Have questions from our audience?
There are no audio questions.
Hi. Meg, this is Kate Gladys. I wanted to ask a couple of questions because, I was intrigued by when you talked about some of your programs early on, and you talked about the promotion piece that you guys weigh heavily on the word of mouth promotion approach, which in actuality, there's probably no stronger salesmanship, stronger way to kind of make a sale than that kind of that kind of approach. And I was wondering if you all have considered, or if you all are using through technologies to kind of have that word of mouth happen in a new way.
That's a really good question. I think, again, when we say word of mouth, in part our ability to do that is, again, we're working within a system that we've taken the time, or researchers have taken the time to get to know. So we understand where the opportunities are to talk, to use word of mouth. I think those systems that we have been working in are developing these other technologies. And as they've done that, we've had a better opportunity to do outreach. I guess, their primary purpose has been to keep people in the loop on legislative issues. I think that's the reason they've really pushed these online social networking kinds of things.
Right.
And we've been able to tap into that infrastructure a little bit to promote some things. But Craig might have some other thoughts on this.
I think the other thing, when you talk about new ways to do word of mouth, I think you're talking about technology. And I think that when we get into technology, even something that's seemingly as simple as a text message, my experience has been when we get past 30 years old, there are a lot of people that don't know how to pick up a text message. And we pretty quickly lose our demographic that we're aiming for when we go into technology. We did work with an online version of the Living Well program and found that while the data suggests there's pretty good use of computers and the internet by people with disabilities, that use is fairly cursory. It's kind of email and perhaps some very, very rudimentary kind of surfing, but not a very intimate knowledge of how to use a computer or how to navigate through different kinds of programs. And so there's a real limitation, I think, in trying to expand into other emerging technologies.
Yeah, and I was actually kind of thinking about it more in the relationship you have, like once you all recruit and kind of are in that maintenance mode of your ambassadors, for example, you know, do you use technology to kind of keep them linked together so you can have kind of like a community of practice where people are sharing ideas or oh gosh, I have this obstacle, has anybody faced this before, and can we use technology as a way to kind of create that community of practice and extend the learning and make it easier for people to do problem solving on the fly and that type of thing. So it less maybe perhaps this idea of social networks and those type of things, less with the direct-to-consumer piece where you're trying to maybe, you know, work with your persons with disabilities as the community itself, and more in that intermediary role where you're trying to recruit and retain and keep interest in within the kind of ambassador type role.
This is Craig again. I know that Iowa, in their Living Well program, tried to put together a listserv and a place on their website for their trained facilitators to connect and to do exactly what you're saying. And perhaps there's somebody on Iowa on the call who can speak to this better than I. But my sense in conversations that I've had is that has not been well utilized. And the reason for that, I don't have a sense of. It would be worth a question to Kate Agarmo or to Mike Honig at the State Department in Iowa.
At this point, we've with our accessibility ambassadors and disability advisors, and while we're in maintenance, we've organized periodic conference calls and for our accessibility ambassadors around visitability, we've organized quarterly meetings with Concrete Change and Eleanor Smith, and so they'll often be looking at a slideshow that we've put on our website. So kind of like today's format, not exactly as supported by the like a webinar kind of format. The RERC RecTech that I alluded to in one of the slides on our continued follow-up with the fitness centers is maybe a little bit more of what you're talking about. They've got a whole group of engineers, so if I'm a fitness center, I could send a picture of my equipment or a barrier, and the engineers would get back with some concrete information about how to solve that problem. So that's something that I know some of our RERCs are working on, strategies to provide technical assistance in the field using technology, but we're not quite there at the program level.
Yeah, that's a great example.
I have received a question here at the AUCD office, and I also wanted to take this opportunity to remind participants that you can submit a question via the text box on the control panel of the GoToWebinar software. At this time, I'll read the question that we have so far. If I am starting to create a health communication message, but I currently don't have connection to existing systems, where could be a recommended starting point? And that can be for either Meg and the folks in Montana or the folks at CDC to answer.
Repeat the question one more time.
Sure. If I'm starting to create a health communication message, but I currently don't have connection to existing systems, where would be a recommended starting point?
This is Martha. I think that knowing about your audience and where they are can be very helpful. So you would just find out about your audience and how can you get the message to where they are.
This is Tracy, man. I'm just thinking that whenever I start a new project or campaign or activity, I'm going to go see what else other people are doing around the same topic. Because you want to find that evidence base, and as Martha said, in your in what you're presenting to people, the science behind the health information, but also in the communication methods that you're using. So let's see what, for example, Montana's doing in accessibility and fitness centers, and then try to learn from other places and start that way. And I think what was great about Meg's presentation, in my opinion, was the numerous partners she kept mentioning, the Centers for Independent Living and all the different groups that are all working together around a common project. And I think pulling in, if you don't have a connection to systems, starting with the people you do know and then pull in more partners and find other people that are trying to tackle the same issue and, you know, try to do more with your small group of partners around a topic or an issue.
And great. Did the folks at Montana have any comments for that question?
Well, no, I think that answers right on.
Great. At this point, I'd like to ask our operator, have we received any audio questions?
There are no audio questions.
Okay. Well, we are nearing the end of time we've allotted for this webinar. So I would like to take the opportunity to thank our presenters and our discussants and, of course, those of you who have participated on today's webinar. I'd like to let you know that the materials will be archived on AUCD's website, and those will go out in a follow-up email to you in the next couple of days. And please fill out the evaluation that will come to you after this webinar. And if you have any questions, please feel free to contact myself or Sue Lynn at AUCD. So with that, thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for participating in today's conference call. You may now disconnect.